to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm interviewing Michael J. Sullivan. Michael is an award-winning epic fantasy author. He has also experienced publishing in all its forms and is currently signed by Orbit Books with his latest book, Heir of Novron, out this month. So welcome, Michael.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks for coming on the show. So first of all, why don't you tell us a bit more about you and your writing background?
Okay, let's see. I started writing novels as far back as high school, and I stayed home when I got older. I actually was into art for a long time, and then I actually was going into being an illustrator, and I worked at that for several years. I actually had a job as an illustrator initially, and then my wife was making a lot more money. She actually graduated as an engineer, and she pulled in 10 times more money than I was ever making. So when we had our first child, I stayed home, and she brought in the money, so I watched the kids. And while I was watching the kids, I went back to writing. At that point, I was actually thinking of doing it, you know, professionally, because I actually was doing it as a full-time job at that point. So I produced a number of books during that time, and I tried to get them published, and I did an awful job of it, to the point where after 10 years of trying and all of my friends going on with their careers, I realized I was kind of wasting my time. I wasn't getting anywhere with this. So I felt like Linus in the pumpkin patch. I wasn't, you know, I was waiting for the great pumpkin to come, and it never was going to happen. So I ended up giving up after writing what I thought was the best novel I could and having it completely rejected. I thought, okay, well, this isn't going to work. So I quit, and I went back into the mainstream working world, and I started as a started an advertising agency, which actually became very good. We had a very good time with that. And I did that for about 12 years. But then I had a daughter who was a bit dyslexic and having a really hard time reading in school. And in order to get her interested in reading, I picked up a new book by J.K. Rowling called Harry Potter. And I ended up having read it myself. And I was like, this is the most fun I've had since the very first time I started writing, which was back in high school when I read The Lord of the Rings. And it was just, I loved it. I didn't like books before that until I read his. And it was a lot of fun. So when I read J.K. Rowling's book, I was like, well, this is the kind of stuff that I used to, that got me excited about reading to begin with. And I hadn't been reading that. I hadn't been reading, you know, Nobel Prize and Pulitzer Prize winning novels to try and learn how to write. And at that point, I was like, oh, this is fun. This is what I like to read. And I thought, well, if I could write something like that, maybe I could get my daughter interested in reading as well. So I ended up writing a series of just fun novels. They were not meant to be published. They were not meant to be anything important at all. And I just sat down and wrote these series of six books. And surprisingly, my daughter said to me one day, she says, well, that's great, but I really don't like reading it in manuscript form. Can you get it published so I can have it all bound? I'm like, all right, I'll try that. So I ended up actually getting those published. My wife actually was the one who did most of the work on getting it published, because she's a marketing and business genius.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got those published.
Oh, well.
But I actually have no background in writing whatsoever. I've never taken a class in it. I've never read a book on it. I've never had a seminar or been a part of a writer's group. Never met a writer until after I'd been published. So
that's awesome. It's an awesome story. I really love that. And what I particularly relate to myself is that I spent so long thinking I needed to write some Pulitzer Prize winning literary fiction novel that it's kind of blocked me. And it sounds like that's what happened to you for a long time. You tried to write the big, important novel.
Well, those years were spent learning. And what I would do is I would try and find books that were big and important, and I would try and emulate them, as you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out what they did. And now, once you get published, you can look back and say, oh, no, those years were spent learning. Those years were spent, you know, building my craft. And it's true. But at the time, you don't think that at all, because until you actually get published, it's just a waste of time. And then once you get published, that's the time that you spent learning.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. Now, I want to come back to that. But first of all, I haven't had very many fantasy writers on my show. So I wanted to ask you, I guess, how do you define epic fantasy as a genre? And how is it faring in the global marketplace, as you say, with fantasy becoming a bit more trendy?
Okay, so fantasy is essentially any story with fantastical elements, things that really can't exist. Like, say, science fiction is probable things, things that could happen. Whereas fantasy, I mean, you have dragons, you have magic, you have things that just don't exist. And they all kind of fall under the this category of speculative fiction, which consists of horror, science fiction, and fantasy. But fantasy is generally just made up things that couldn't possibly exist in the real world. Epic fantasy has to deal with the scope. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of Gone with the Wind. I mean, that's an epic scoped story. It has a lot to it. And in most fantasy books, you have multiple nations and religions and political structures and lots of different characters and lots of different backstories and plot lines that are run into it. That's what generally makes it epic. It's huge, it's big, it's sweeping in its nature. So that's essentially, you know, what the genre is. Secondly, how well it's doing, I would say it's doing very well due to people like, well, first of all, The Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson's movies really popularized that. And following on that, of course, we had Harry Potter, which also, I think, indoctrinated a lot of young people into the fantasy genre. So now that they're getting older, they're also looking for more of that, I suspect. And then, of course, most recently, we have George R.R. Martin's HBO special, which is doing phenomenally well. And again, more people who would never normally read fantasy are now picking it up due to those very popularized versions.
Mm. Can I ask you about gender as well? Because, you know, we see romance as a kind of female-dominated market in terms of the authors who write it. I'm not even talking readers. Is fantasy a male-dominated area?
It tends to be, I think. In fact, I was reading a blog post recently by a fellow Orbit writer, Jemison, I forget her whole full name, it's terrible about me, but she was saying that she felt that a lot of epic fantasy that is written by women is not classified as epic fantasy for some strange reason, even though they should be. So I suspect that that's probably true. I think because most young men were always very nerdy and they were the ones who were into this, and I don't think is women aren't nerdy. They're much more sophisticated than that.
Yeah, right.
At least that is the impression we're supposed to have. So I suspect that that may have something to do with it.
No, I find it's an interesting thing because I write a kind of thrillers that, and I have a lot of feedback that I write like a man, and I'm like, maybe I should become a man in my pen name, you know, Jonathan Penn.
There are, I think, a lot of women who do that, who actually do write under male pen names for that very reason, because they'll be taken more seriously.
Exactly. So it's funny. So I wanted to ask you, so for people listening who are interested in writing epic fantasy or fantasy, what are your sort of top three tips in writing that genre?
Well, I kind of think if you're writing science fiction, you probably should know science. But if you're writing history, or writing fantasy, I think history is probably what you want to be somewhat knowledgeable, because you can draw a lot of things from history. You just learned a lot of things that you can use. And so having some sort of knowledge of background history would be one. The second would be to take what you learned in history and mix and match. Like if you were to take things out of Greek history and put it in the medieval form, or out of Chinese history and bring it into whatever setting you want to do, because, I mean, there are very different settings. Most of it is medieval, generally speaking, but you can also have it be in Greek, or there's a lot of very popular fantasy coming out now that's set in like a Middle Eastern kind of setting. But by taking things and just kind of saying, well, what would have happened if you know, the United States had actually taken over England as opposed to the other way around, or if China had been an expansionary, you know, empire as opposed to just staying where they were. I mean, these are things that you can kind of explore in fantasy. You just give them different names, but it gives you a foundation and a certain legitimacy and a certain sense of place, and things seem to make more sense if you base it on history. So I think that's one of them. Also, I would have to say that when you make a world, writers have a tendency to create a lot, but I wouldn't say you'd want to put all that into a book. Like, for my books, I've actually created about 8,000 years of history. I'm not going to put all that in the book. But that's good as a writer to know all that, because it gives you an understanding of the undercurrents and how things are built. And if you tell someone a story and you don't tell them the whole story, you leave lots out, they'll get a sense that there is a lot missing, and they'll get a sense that this is a real place. Because when you tell someone about your day, you're not going to tell them everything. So they know that there's more there than there actually is, and that gives it a sense of weight and a sense of depth. just in the fact that they know you're leaving things out. You're just touching on some things that I'm not going to talk about that right now, but I'm going to tell you this part of it. And they'll go, oh, but there is more. And that makes it seem more real. And I think all too often people make a lot of history and they want to jam that all in the book and it becomes boring and it tends to drag it down. So just using kind of the tip of the iceberg rule of not including everything you invent.
And what is the word count thing with fantasy? Why do they all have to be so long?
They don't, actually. The books that I originally wrote, I wrote 6 books, and I don't think any one of, well, the very last one would be over it. Most of them were only about 300 pages, which was all about 100, I think the first one was 97,000 words, and then I think the longest one was 160,000 words. So, but most of them average about 300 words. And I actually had a lot of people raising their eyebrow at that, saying, well, why are these so short? Because they're so used to long books. And when they were finally republished under Orbit, they put two together and they became big books again. I don't know why that is. I think a lot of people get turned off. A lot of mainstream people who are not indoctrinated in the fantasy world get turned off by the huge books. Like, well, I don't know if I want to invest that much time into that kind of book. But a little book, they'll read that. So I have no idea why that is.
Yeah, I wonder with the, you know, there's a move with ebooks, you know, that word count doesn't matter so much, right. Whether you would split your, you know, if you were, I know you're with a traditional publisher now, but would you split things down even further so that you could have 10 in a series instead of 6, for example?
No, I always, I don't know why, I just happen to always write about 100,000 words. It's just something that I just started doing. I don't know how I ended up doing it. It's just natural. When I end the story, that's about where it is. And actually, I was accused by several people that I was, my publisher was forcing me to make them small like that. So that they could sell more titles and make more money. They didn't know that I was self-publishing at the time. So it was kind of funny. But yeah, it has nothing to do with that. It was just that's where the story ended. And so that's why they always came out short. I don't know why.
No, it's an interesting thing. Right, so you wrote a really nice article on what every author needs to know if they want to make a living as a writer. And I wondered if maybe you could talk a bit about that, some of those things that people have to do.
Well, you don't want to do what I did. I pretty much did everything wrong, I think. Like I said earlier, I wrote in a complete vacuum, and I learned how to write with absolutely no input from anyone else, which was kind of silly because once I started talking to the people, I learned a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't know. It's like opening the trade route suddenly between East and West. I'm like, oh, really? I didn't know you had things like spices. So in this case, I had no idea there was such a thing as like point of views show, don't tell. I mean, these were things that were completely I was oblivious to at the time. So don't follow what I did very closely. But some of the things I would say you'd want to do is you probably want to write a good book to begin with. And that's actually, you're like, well, how do you do that? Everyone thinks you write a good book. But I think what you really want to do is you want to write something that you enjoy reading. And like we were talking about earlier, that the fact that you don't want to try and write the great book. You don't want to try and write like someone else. You have to figure out. See, what I actually ended up doing was I was looking out there at the marketplace and I couldn't find the type of book that I wanted to read. I found a lot of books that were interesting, some that were entertaining, but nothing that I was like, wow, this is a great book. And I was kind of disappointed at that. So I wanted to write that kind of book. I wanted to write the book that I loved. And the aspects of that, I broke down, like, well, what did I like in a book? And I realized that in the fantasy genre, was where my favorite books were, that I always liked the fact that you had characters that were like people who you'd want to have as friends, real life people. Like, I would really enjoy to have these characters in real life as friends. And I wanted to have a place where you'd like to go to, that you would like to spend. Because I remember reading Lord of the Rings or Watership Down, like, that's a wonderful world. It'd be great to live there. So when you open the book, it takes you someplace you want to go. And then if you want to have a plot that just the pages turn. You're not even noticing the writing. It's just something that just sweeps you away and you get lost. So you put that book up and whatever troubles you may be experiencing in your life, you forget about because you're gone. And after that, that's what I wanted to write in a book. And the next thing you probably want to do is you want to write something in a genre because there's a reason why they call there's literary fiction and then there's genre fiction. The reason why there's another name for genre fiction, it's called popular fiction. And the reason for that is because it's popular. More people buy that. If you look at the statistics, I mean, literary fiction is not as popular. Not as many people are reading that. Also, you have a market you can direct yourself to. If you're selling to a specific genre, you can target that a lot easier. which makes life a little bit easier, unless, of course, you're writing nonfiction, which is even easier in that respect. But if you're writing genre fiction, that's going to help you out. The next thing is you write a series. I found, again, this is kind of a sheer accident. I didn't mean to actually do this. But if you write a series, and because you put one book out, people will read it. You get 50 people reading that book. Fine. Now you're dead. That's it. But if you have another book in the series come out, you get another 50 readers, and they're different. But they realize that that's the second book, so they pick that next book up. So now you have 100 readers, and you get another one, and it begins advertising the previous two, and then the other one you get the previous three. So it builds a fan base who are all interested in that story, because if you write a completely different book and it's not as appealing to the same people, you'll lose fans. But if you're writing one ongoing story, you get the snowballing effect where you get larger and larger numbers of fans reading your stuff. Mm. Next, you have to be somewhat prolific. You have to keep putting books out there if you want to make a living at it. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to make a living off of one or two books, because the amount of money you're going to be bringing in, regardless of whether you're traditionally published or whether you're self-published or even through a small publisher, you're not going to be able to get that kind of money unless you have a number of books bringing it in. One book will bring in just a small amount. You might get $5,000 in advance for one book. Two, you get oncoming revenue stream coming in, three, four, five. Finally, you start getting to a point where you get to about five books where you're going to start actually seeing enough money that you might be able to live off of it.
Okay.
And then, of course, you have to market. You have to actually get out there. You have to sell. And this is something that authors don't want to do. Most authors are rather introverted people who sit in their room and like to invent worlds in their head. They don't even like talking to other people, much less going out and saying, "Hi, I'm great. You should buy my stuff." It's anathema to most of us to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's the harshest thing that you realize. When you get to that point, you're like, oh my God, I have to now sell myself. If I wanted to be a salesman, I would have sold cars for a living, not written books. But yeah, that's something you absolutely have to do, unless you just want to just write books and then throw your manuscripts in the trash, which I actually did for about 10 years, and it's very depressing. But if you actually want people to read it, then you actually have to let them know that you wrote it. And the only way to do that is to be going out and to being a social marketer and going to cons and talking to people.
Mm. Yep, and I wonder if you could comment on the kind of the pervasive myth that being prolific means lower quality, as in people seem to have this opinion that if you write a couple of books a year, that means you're writing too fast. What do you think about that?
Actually, kind of strange. In the old days, yes, that was the prevailing idea that people would take a decade to write a great book. Nowadays, that's not the case in any sense of the world. Even in traditional publishing, they now expect you to be putting out more than one book a year. So I know many people who are they're being requested to put out more than one book, because the number of books you have out there, and every time you put out a new book, your name comes up, you get reviews. It's a huge marketing tool to have a new book. So it's not even in the sense of like self-publishers who crank them out quickly, and they can do that because they don't have the production time behind that. They don't send those books out for review in advance, because usually you have to send the book out 6 months to a year in advance for a review. And then you also have the production cost of getting it set up in catalogs and getting it sold to stores. That's what slows down the traditional publishing. Whereas if you're self-publishing, you can kind of bypass that and get books out a lot faster. But even traditional wants you to do it fairly quickly now. As far as quality is concerned, everyone writes at different speeds, and I don't really think you should rush a writer, but I think that if you're writing, this is the problem, is that a lot of people are not just writing.
Yeah.
You generally can't make a living writing for the most part, so people have day jobs. So they're doing this in their off time, so that makes it a little bit hard. But if you are writing full time, that's an 8-hour-a-day job, and you can actually put out quite a bit of words during that time. And so in some cases, I think it's some writers are just polishing for forever. And that may be slowing them down. But I think a lot of cases it's because they actually have very little time. They actually are doing a full-time job. They're marketing themselves. And on top of that, they're also trying to write a novel. So I wouldn't pressure anyone to do that. But if someone can get the books out, and the quality of the book is going to be determined by how many people are buying it and how many people are reading it. Because if you sell one book, great. But if that same people come back and buy your second book, then they must have liked something about the first book. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing very well. I mean, it's sort of a self-correcting marketplace.
Yeah. No, that I like that answer. That's excellent. So I wanted to then ask you, being a full-time writer as you are now, how much time do you actually spend writing? I mean, I know you have Robin who does a lot of marketing, but how much of it is writing? How much is doing the other things that a pro writer has to do?
All right. So I think this is pretty consistent. I've actually talked to other writers, and they all seem to kind of say the same things, that we all write in the morning. I'm sure there's some night people, but most of us, for some reason, when you're doing this for a living, you write in the morning, because that's the time when people don't bother you. It's quiet and you're alert. You're not sleepy or anything. So I generally will write from like 8 o'clock in the morning until like maybe 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And I break for lunch, and that's it for the day. I won't write anymore that day. The rest of the day is spent either doing promotions, marketing, writing blog posts, doing whatever errands I need to do around the house, or spending time with my family. But it's not, you know, I don't try to overcome, because you get to a certain point where you start really getting tired, and you can tell that the quality of writing is starting to suffer, and that's when you need to stop. Now, there's been other times when I've just been on a roll where I'll come back after dinner and I'll write, because I'm like, oh, I just want to get this stuff down. And if you're doing that, it's great to keep writing, because you get so much more done. But generally speaking, I'll only write about half the day. And I think that's pretty much the rule for most people, and has been for years. That, I mean, even your big writers going back into the 20s, they didn't write all day long. They wrote for part of the day, and the rest of the day they took off to let their brain and subconscious kind of settle down and relax.
No, I feel you can't write creatively for like 8 to 12 hours a day, can you? You just can't pull it out.
You do, but you don't do it on a typewriter or a keyboard. Because, I mean, I'm constantly writing. It's always in my head. Every time I see something, I'll think, oh, yes, I could use that, and that could work this way. So I'm constantly doing that job. It's like people often talk about how writers are, you know, they only work so many hours, only a few hours a day, and I'll say, it's so easy. But like, yeah, but when you talk about a person who's working in an office, you think, they aren't working that long either. I mean, they're on the phone, they're having meetings. And that's what you do when you're writing. You may be out walking the dog, but you're working on your story, because half the time, half of the job of working is thinking and working out plot lines, is developing characters. So that's pretty much equivalent to me having, you know, meetings or talking to someone on the phone or writing email. And you also, of course, are writing email, and you're also doing blog posts, and all of that is part of it. So you're actually probably working 16 hours a day as a writer. But for some reason, people only give you credit for the time you're actually typing words for a novel or a short story. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, no, it's true. Well, that's why I asked the question, because I know it's not true. Now, I wanted to, let's talk about publishing, because you have experienced, you know, you've done the self-publishing, you've done the small press and mainstream publishing. So how do you feel about the current state of publishing, and why have you gone mainstream, I guess, when it seems to be the other way at the moment, everyone's jumping on indie?
Well, I think the answer to that question is, it depends on what you want. And I've actually had this before. It's like, you know, should you self-publish? Should you traditionally publish? You know, should you indie publish? All those things. I'm like, well, you really have to decide what you want. And most authors, I don't think, really know. When they started this, well, I'll say, well, do you want to have your book on every shelf in the nation? Yes. Do you want to make lots of money? Yes. Do you want to have all the, you know, the clout and reputation of being, you know, a published author? Yes. Well, you can't actually have all those things. You know, do you want absolute control of your book? Yes, of course. I mean, but you can't have these things. You have to decide which one of those things you want. Because if you self-publish, odds are you have complete control over everything, which is great. Most people like that. And if you want to be on every shelf in the nation, you actually have to, you know, go through traditional publishing for that. You're not going to get that if you self-publish. And, you know, and if you don't want to go through the work of constantly you know, marketing yourself and going through the effort of getting it in every store and doing distribution and doing cover art, some of that, you don't want to be self-publishing, because that's what you're going to have to do for that. So it depends on what you're really looking for as a goal. Do you want to make a lot of money? The best place to probably make a good deal of money without having to do as much work is self-publishing, because you don't have to sell as many copies to make a decent amount. I actually was making quite a bit of money self-publishing, because I was making much more per book. So I didn't have to sell as many books to make a living. As a traditional publisher, I had to sell a lot more books to make very little money comparatively. But why did I do that? Because I had already taken the series. I had already made a financial success of it. So now I wanted to take it to that next step, which I couldn't do. I didn't feel I could do in self-publishing, which I wanted to bring it to a larger audience. I wanted it to be nationwide. I wanted to have people who would not normally read the book have a chance to notice it. I wanted it to be easier for my foreign publishing, my foreign agent, to be able to sell it. And they're much more likely to buy a book that is produced by a traditional publisher. So it has done exactly this. It has, I'm constantly getting a much larger audience now than I did then. In fact, when I first published the book, self-published, I had a number of, a lot of buzz. And now I'm getting the exact same buzz again, which I wouldn't have had if I stayed self-publishing, because it would have died out. It was slowly starting to settle down, but now I'm getting that wave again, and I'm hitting a whole new audience. So it's expanding my fan base tremendously, and that really helps out for what I wanted to do. I'd already achieved the one goal. Now I was moving on to the second goal. And I think when you're starting out as a writer, you have to figure out what you want to do. Do you want to have that self-satisfaction of saying, I did the big dream of getting a traditional publisher, or I am in every shelf in the nation? Or is it you don't really care? Because I know authors who don't care. Authors who are getting older now, they're starting out for the first time. What they're looking for is an income that they can rely on as they get older. You know, just they can have 5 books out there that will constantly be bringing in a decent income for them, you know, as they are getting to an age where they really can't work anymore. And that's sort of insurance for them. And I can certainly see that. And they don't want to have to take all the time of all the work of getting published any other way. So it depends really on what you're looking for when you're trying to decide what your goals are. But you have to kind of figure out what you really want.
Yeah. And then I'm interested because, of course, you know, you said at the beginning you spent all these years trying to get traditionally published, and now then you went indie and then you got traditionally published. How did you sell your series that had already sold so many copies? How did you sell that to traditional publishing?
Well, I actually didn't. My wife thought she would try and get an agent, and we actually talked to our foreign agent and said, you know, do you know any agents who would handle this domestically? She said, well, I would be more than happy to try that. And we thought it would take a year, and it didn't. She had it in like 2 weeks or a month, I think it was. But what she, I think one of the main selling points of it, which, you know, it wasn't, I had sent it to the larger publishers years ago, and they weren't as interested. But now we were able to come to them with numbers. We were able to say, listen, we have sold 70,000 copies of this right at this moment, you know, or it, I don't know if it was at that moment or soon afterwards, but we were on the movers and shakers list on Amazon. So it was huge. And they're like, wow, this is okay. This is something to be noticed. But this is a commodity that is immediately worth money. So that got us in the door. I think that's the first thing that made them say, all right, well, let's look at it. And then they read the story. And I think if they read the actual story, that also sold them. According to my editor, that's what really sold her. And then she became the champion of it in the marketing or in the traditional publishing realm. And she said, oh, yeah, this is good. And then I had a few different publishers who were bidding on it at that point.
Oh, no, that's great. Because, you know, it's something I'm personally interested in myself, in that, you know, by the mid-year I should have sort of 50,000 to 70,000 sales as well. And I'm thinking, well, that's actually quite a good point at which you can approach a publisher.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, if you walk up to them and say, this is a big bag of money that you can have, most people are interested in saying, oh, really, that sounds like an interesting, let me read it. But I don't think that guarantees it, but it certainly helps get their attention. And then once they read the story, they figure out how that fits in with their company, because I'm sure, like with Orbit, they have a certain type of book that I think they like. I think if you read most of Orbit books, they're all kind of along the right line. They're all kind of new and up and coming. And they tend to pick quality books. So I think for whatever reason, I was writing fit in with their style and what they felt they could promote. So I think the two of those combined is what caused them to pick it up.
Yeah, and then almost out of time, but you and Robin now have this, you know, this great thing going, as far as I can see, where you're both, it looks like you're both doing what you want to do with your lives. You know, how has that happened? And, you know, are you both living this dream now?
Oh, yeah, it's well, last April she was able to quit her job, which she was very happy to do, and now she is like my full-time publicist, and she has her own company, Write and Publishing, where she has her own agents and her own authors that she takes care of. So yeah, she's much happier now than she used to be. And of course, I've been doing this same thing now for quite some time, because she's always been kind of bringing in the income, and I was able to stay home and write to begin. So it really doesn't change my life, except for the fact that I feel so much better knowing that I'm not having to force her to do something she doesn't want to do to support me, and that makes life so much easier.
Oh, yeah. I think it's lovely what you two have done. And for people listening, we have an interview with Robin last year, about last November, I think. So I'll add notes to that. Okay, so why don't you tell us a bit more about your series and also where people can find your books?
Okay, yeah. So it's just a good old-fashioned fun adventure, as we kind of discussed. It was the kind of the book that I wanted to have that really people would enjoy. And I couldn't find anything quite like that in the market, because nowadays fantasy has become sort of dark and gritty and cynical, and that's really not what I wanted. I wanted something to be fun and enjoyable. So I ended up coming up with this idea, a simple little idea of these two thieves who are hired to steal a sword out of a castle, and they go and they do this, and they find the they go to where the sword is supposed to be, and instead they find the dead body of a king, and they realize, uh-oh, and they're grabbed, and they realize they've just been set up to take the murder of this king, and they obviously didn't do it. So now they have to figure out how to clear their name and escape this terrible problem they've been. And in the course of doing that, they uncover a conspiracy that keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, that extends over the course of six books. And the six books, I actually wrote every single one before it was published. So I was able to go back and make sure all the mysteries and all the hints and all the little tidbits that are put in there, so they're, and the Easter eggs are hidden throughout the book, so that as you read it, you can kind of guess, well, what's going to happen. And I keep making sure that I twist it so that you're never quite sure how this is going to turn out. And I've always loved that kind of a book. I was like, well, I wonder how this is going to turn out. This means something, but I don't know what it is. And then later on, you get to it. Yes, I knew that was going to be. So that's the kind of thrill that I wanted to have when I read books, and that was one I wanted to have. So that's the kind of book I decided to write. But it's a fun, it has humor, it will make you both laugh and cry. I've had people who, most recently, the last book, have called me and said, you know, I'm a grown man and I'm a tough guy, but you made me bawl like a child. And at the same time, right after that, I'm laughing my head off, and I was like, this is just amazing. So yeah, so it's that kind of thing. Someone else said, I'm not a subtle writer, and I'm not really trying to be. I'm trying to make people, you know, get some emotion out of you, make it an enjoyable read. It's not, it generally should make you feel better about yourself and the world in general, and it's not something that will make you necessarily think about things, but it will make you happy and generally entertain you.
Oh, good. And where can people find you and your books?
Well, you can buy them anywhere, really, anywhere books are sold. But you can get them on Amazon, you can get them at Barnes and Noble, just about any retail. Like I said, they're about on every bookshelf in the country here, and you can also get them through Orbit UK. I believe they're available both in Canada, United Kingdom, and Australia as well as the United States. But yeah, I've been going around doing drive-by signings in different bookstores, and they're pretty much everywhere.
And your website?
My website is ryira.com. That's RIYRIA.com.
Right, okay.
So,
And
yeah. So,
that's
and
the.
the book is Theft of Swords, obviously.
Yeah,
The first
okay.
one.
Theft of Swords. I was going to ask you, we haven't actually mentioned the title, so.
Yeah, Theft of Swords, Rise of Empire, and Heir of Navran. Yes, we get this whole series and you never mention the books.
That's brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Michael. That was great.
You're welcome. I'm so happy you had me here.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time.